Chapter 37 Mom and Dad. The officer turned me around and handcuffed me, then put me in the back of his car. This wasn't what I had expected, and I wondered what was going on. Staring through the window, I saw the other officers surrounding Brian David Mitchell and Wanda Barzee. I watched as they were handcuffed, but then the officer started talking to me, and I had to look away. By the time I turned back, Mitchell and Barzee were gone. It would be many years before I would see them again. The policemen told me they were taking me down to the station. The police car started moving. I'd never been inside a police car, and I had to crane my neck to see out of the divider that separated me from the front seat. The cuffs were uncomfortable, and it scared me, not being able to move my arms. I was feeling just as fearful as I had felt before. Why had they handcuffed me? What had I done wrong? Did they think it was my fault? Did they think I was a criminal, like Mitchell? We rode along in silence. What's going to happen to them? I finally asked. I could tell by the look on the policeman's face that he thought that I was worried about them, like maybe I wanted to be with them, or that I wanted to make sure they'd be okay. Nothing could have been further from the truth. I was scared to death that they might put me in the same cell as Mitchell. I was certain he would kill me if they did. That was the only reason that I asked. I just wanted to know if they were going to keep me safe. The officer didn't answer, so I stared out the window and wondered what was going to happen to me as we rode along in silence. I was nearly overcome by everything that had just happened. I had gone from being a hopeless prisoner to being someone who would soon be free. But it hadn't hit me yet, and I wasn't sure that it was real. I wasn't sure that something wasn't going to happen that would take it all away. We drove to the police station, where I was uncuffed and led into a small room. There were no windows, only a shabby sofa, and all of the walls were bare. My heart was still racing. I had no idea what to expect. "You can take off your disguise," a policeman told me before he left the room. I immediately pulled off the dark glasses and the nasty wig and dropped them on the floor. I sat alone. No one came to me. Were they going to let me call my mom and dad? Were they going to send me to prison? Surely they'd let me talk to someone before they sent me away. Maybe they were going to let me go, but if they were going to set me free, wouldn't they have done it already? I wanted to stand and test the door to see if it was locked, but I didn't dare. I was terrified that I would open it and see Mitchell standing there. I don't know how long I was in the room, but it seemed to be a lifetime. My heart was constantly racing. As I sat there, I kept thinking about being sent to prison. I decided that it didn't sound that bad. Compared to what I had been living through, it would have been a huge improvement. As long as they didn't put me back with Mitchell, it was going to be okay. I leaned back on the sofa and tried to relax. Suddenly, the door flew open. Looking up, I felt my heart leap. My dad was standing there. He looked at me as if he were seeing a ghost. His face showed absolute shock, as if I couldn't be real. The dead was living. His daughter had come home. I looked at him and waited. Time froze. My heart stopped. I don't know if I breathed. We stared at each other for what seemed like an eternity, but must have been less than a second. Then my daddy ran to me and grabbed me and started hugging me as only a father can. It was a grasp of desperation and giddy happiness and absolute disbelief. It was a hug of relief and happiness that is impossible to describe. But I felt it, and I knew he felt it. We held on to each other very tight. Then he pulled away and looked at me, staring into my face. "Elizabeth, is it really you?" It took me a moment before I was able to answer. "Yeah, Dad, it's me." Both of us started crying, a swell of emotion that erupted from the very bottoms of our souls. Then it seemed I heard a voice inside my head. "You are home. You are home. It's going to be okay." I leaned into my dad's shoulder and held on like I was going to drown. Your dad is there. You are safe. He will never let another person hurt you. Your mom will always stand beside you. It is going to be okay. We hugged and cried a while, neither of us saying anything. Then an officer stepped carefully into the room. We need to take you to Salt Lake City headquarters, he said. My dad turned around to look at him. Mr. Smart, could you and your daughter come with us? We have a car waiting. We were escorted through the corridors to a back door where a maroon police car was waiting. We climbed into the back seat. One patrol car pulled in front of us and another pulled in behind. The moment we had pulled out of the parking lot, my dad looked at me and exclaimed, "We have to call your mom!" He pulled out his cell phone and started punching at the numbers. I could hear her phone ring and then her voice say, "Hello?" My dad was shouting, "Lois, it's her! It's really her! She's alive!" My mom started screaming into the phone, "Yes, yes, it's true!" My dad shouted back, "No, I'm with her! She's alive! She's okay! I'm with her right now!" I could hear my mom's voice screaming even louder through the phone. "Let me talk to her! Pass the phone! Pass the phone! Is she hurt? Is she all right? Pass the phone!" My dad handed me the phone. "Mom?" I said, my voice barely more than a whisper. "Elizabeth? Is that really you? Are you okay? Is it true? Is that you? Are you all right?" Her voice sounded exactly as I remembered it, and for a fraction of a second, I flashed back to those first days on the mountain, reliving the fear that I might forget the sound of her voice. "It's okay. You are home. It's going to be okay." "Mom?" I started to answer, when the cell phone battery went dead. Ugh! Seriously, of all the things that could have happened... My dad looked at me sheepishly and tried to smile. It seemed to take forever to get to the police headquarters, but we finally made it, and I was escorted to another private room. My mom was waiting for me. Seeing her, I almost felt like I couldn't breathe. She looked just like an angel. Nobody could ever look as beautiful as she looked to me. She jumped up and ran to me and started hugging me so tightly, I really couldn't breathe. She was crying. I was crying. It was the same thing as with my dad. We held on to each other like we would never let go. We cried and hugged and smiled and laughed. "Elizabeth, Elizabeth," she repeated again and again. She could hardly let me go when one of the officers came back into the room. "Elizabeth, we need to ask you a few questions." I looked desperately at my mom. I didn't want to go. Why couldn't I stay with her? My dad was already gone, somewhere in the police station, talking to some of the officers. "Elizabeth, we need to talk to you," the officer pressed. Reluctantly, my mom let me go. The officer escorted me into another room. A woman and a man were waiting there. They introduced themselves as investigators, then started asking me all sorts of questions. I answered as best as I could, but I felt overwhelmed. I was on the edge of breaking down. After everything that had happened to me, I just wanted to go home. "I just want to be with my parents," I finally cried. "I just want to see my family. Can't we do this later? Can't I please go home?" My dad suddenly stormed into the room. They had no right to take me from them, and he was very mad. "We will do this later," he demanded, his face red with anger. There was no way he was going to let them question me right then and there. He pulled me from the room and out into the hall. Down the corridor we went, back into the same room that my mom and I had been in before. My brothers and little sister were waiting for me. It was all of the crying and hugging and laughing all over again. It was one of the rare moments that is pure and incomprehensible joy. Some people may live their entire lives and never feel what we felt in that moment. It was beautiful. It was magic. It was everything that I could have asked for. All of our family was together. I was really home. We were safe. Mitchell wasn't going to hurt us. I had my entire life before me. Everything was going to be okay. William, the baby, was 4 years old now. He didn't join in the hugging. Instead, he looked at me with great suspicion. I tried to pick him up, but he turned away and reached out for my mom. That broke my heart a bit. I've been gone a long, long time, I thought. Don't worry, Elizabeth, my mom assured me. He'll remember you. Just give him a little time. Then my oldest brother, Charles, came forward and held me by the arms. I have felt so terrible, not only because I wasn't there to protect you, but because the last thing I ever said to you was to tease you about some stupid little thing. I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry. But I promise, never again will I say goodbye without telling you I love you. That will always be the last thing that I say whenever we say goodbye again. And he was right. He always says that now. It is one of the reasons that I love him and why I'm so glad he is my brother. Another officer stepped into the room. We need to take you to the hospital to do a checkup, he said. Once again, I was separated from my family, but this time, my mom came with me. She wasn't leaving my side again. We were rushed out a back door of the police headquarters and into a white van with darkened windows. I couldn't believe how many people were waiting, hoping to get a glimpse of me. There were hundreds of reporters and photographers and well-wishers along the road. I was shocked. It seemed incredible. All of them were there for me. At the hospital, I was poked and prodded and tested in pretty much every way you can imagine. But I didn't mind so much because I was with my mom. After the examination, I had to give up the clothes that I was wearing. The police wanted to keep them for evidence. I was more than happy to get rid of them. They were a piece of another life, another world. I wanted to put it all behind me. Besides, they were so filthy and disgusting. Cast-offs from a homeless camp. I hated to even touch them anymore. But what was I going to wear out of the hospital? I couldn't leave in just a gown. My mom and a couple of the hospital staff rustled up a white sweatsuit and some white booties for my feet. The outfit was far too small, and I felt ridiculous. But there was nothing else to do. Holding hands, my mother and I made our way to another private door on the back side of the hospital and climbed into the waiting police van. On the way home, the officers were wondering how to get me into my house without subjecting me to the massive crowd that had gathered outside. They talked about driving into the backyard, but there was no way that was going to work. They eventually settled on just driving into my garage and not letting me out of the van until the garage door had come down. Turning onto the street that led to my house, I saw for the first time all of the media and other people had come to celebrate my return. It was nearly overwhelming. Once again, I had to wonder that all of those people were there for me. We pulled into the garage and I waited in the van, but I could hear 100 voices shouting, crying, calling out my name. I shook my head in disbelief. Walking into the house, my house, I stood in the middle of the living room and took a long look around. It seemed like I had died and gone to heaven. The lights were so bright, the carpet was so soft, the furniture was so beautiful. My family stood inside the room and looked at me. To me, they were a vision. I was so glad to be home. "Well, what do you want to do?" my mother asked. The answer was really easy. I wanted to take a bath. Mom took me upstairs and led me toward my bedroom. Walking in, I was shocked to see that all my clothes were exactly as I had left them on the night I had been taken. I turned to my mother. "Mom, you couldn't even fold my clothes for me?" I teased. She didn't laugh. She didn't even smile. She looked away embarrassed, then turned back and wiped her eyes. "Elizabeth, I couldn't. I just couldn't." She had to pause to clear her throat. She shook her head sadly. "Every time I came in here to organize your things, I started crying. It was too hard. It was too painful. I simply couldn't do it. I don't know if you'll ever understand." I reached out and held her. And as I did, a thought came into my mind. Your mom did her best. She has tried so hard to be so strong. We picked up a few things in the room. Then I took a beautiful bubble bath. It felt better than anything I had ever felt before. By then, it was time to go to bed. My parents gathered us around to have our family prayers. There were plenty of thanks to be given. It was a beautiful thing. After prayers, I got up, said goodnight to my parents, and started walking up to my bedroom. Both of my parents just stared at me. "We were thinking," my dad said with a bit of hesitation, "you know, maybe we'd pull your mattress into our bedroom and you could sleep by us on the floor." I almost laughed. "No, Dad, no more floors for me. I want to sleep in my own bed." They only looked at me. They were not satisfied. "Mom, Dad, I promise I'll be here in the morning." It turned out that I hadn't convinced them. I woke up several times that night to see them standing in the darkness, checking to make sure that I was safe. The next morning, I woke up before my brothers or sister did. After struggling to find some clothes that fit me, I'd grown a lot over the past 9 months. I got dressed and went downstairs. Coming down the stairs, I met my dad walking through the front door with a green teddy bear and a bouquet of chrysanthemums. "Wow, thanks, Dad," I said. I thought he was being nice. "They're not for me," he said. "Someone brought them to the front door and asked me to give them to you." But that was just the beginning. A few hours later, our house looked like a floral shop. Once again, I had to wonder, all of this for me? Sometime in the early morning, my grandparents burst into the house. They were frantic with happiness and exhaustion. They had driven all night from Palm Springs to come to see me. I don't know for certain, but it seems they may have broken a speed limit or two to get there so fast. Hearing all the commotion from my grandparents' entry, the other kids woke up and came downstairs. We all stood in the middle of the room and hugged each other. To my great relief, my baby brother William joined in the hug. I felt so loved, so safe. I had not felt this way in a very long time. I am home. I am home. Everything is going to be okay. The only thing I wanted to do was to have another bath. Then, while the other members of my family were waiting in the living room, my mom pulled me aside at the top of the stairs. "Before it gets too crazy, I need to tell you something," she said. I turned to look at her. She was so beautiful to me. "This is important," she started. I could see from the look on her face that it was. I listened as intently as I could, and I'm very glad I did, for what she was about to say turned out to be the best advice that anyone has ever given me. In fact, I would say it changed my life. "Elizabeth, what this man has done is terrible. There aren't any words that are strong enough to describe how wicked and evil he is. He has taken 9 months of your life that you will never get back again. But the best punishment you could ever give him is to be happy, is to move forward with your life, to do exactly what you want. Because, yes, this will probably go to trial and some kind of sentencing will be given to him and that wicked woman. But even if that's true, you may never feel like justice has been served or that true restitution has been made. But you don't need to worry about that. At the end of the day, God is our ultimate judge. He will make up to you every pain and loss that you have suffered. And if it turns out that these wicked people are not punished here on earth, it doesn't matter. His punishments are just. You don't ever have to worry. You don't ever have to even think about them again." She paused as if the next words were the most important. "You be happy, Elizabeth. Just be happy. If you go and feel sorry for yourself, or if you dwell on what has happened, if you hold on to your pain, that is allowing him to steal more of your life away. So don't you do that. Don't you let him. There is no way that he deserves that. Not one more second of your life. You keep every second for yourself. You keep them and be happy. God will take care of the rest. It's been 10 years since my mother said those words. The years have proven she was right. Chapter 38, Comfort in My Bed. The first night I lay in my bed, I found it hard to sleep. My legs were agitated and I felt restless. The night was dark, and the yellow light from the streetlights filtered into my room. If I held still, I could hear the occasional sound of cars driving on the road behind my house. Tomahawk Drive, the road where Mitchell had forced me to hide behind the bushes while the police car had driven by. I lay underneath my soft comforter, my head atop my fluffy pillow. It almost felt uncomfortable sleeping in a real bed. For the first time in months, I was going to sleep without suffering from hunger. I was clean. I hadn't just been raped. I hadn't just been forced to do things that I couldn't even speak about. I was surrounded by my family. I wasn't thirsty or exhausted. I hadn't been forced to drink a cup of dirty rainwater to keep my thirst down. I hadn't been forced to drink so much alcohol that I was sick. I hadn't just had a pornographic magazine shoved in my face. I wasn't cold. I wasn't hot. I wasn't lonely. I didn't have to lie in bed and wonder, what are my mom and dad doing? Are they okay? Were they happy? Did they think about me anymore? I didn't have to wonder, what will my future look like? How long was Mitchell going to live? Would I ever be free again? Would I ever go to school? Would there ever be anyone else in my life except from Barzi and Mitchell? I had my life back. I had a future. Everything that had been stolen had been given back to me. I thought back, my mind drifting into memories that were powerful and very clear. Waking up that night, right there in that very bed, the same yellow light filtering through the window, and a long knife at my neck. Hiking up the mountain, asking Mitchell that if he was going to kill me, he'd do it near the trail where my body could be found. Walking into the high camp and meeting Barzi, her cold smile, her hard embrace, the white robes. The first time that he raped me, Barzi sitting passively outside the tent. All of these memories came flooding into my mind. But there were other memories that I lived through that night as well. Memories that gave me hope. Memories that gave me comfort. The constant feeling that I was not alone, that God had never left me, that he was as close as any prayer. The assurance that my grandfather had been called back home so that he could walk beside me, my heavenly bodyguard. The night I had been given a cup of cold water by my pillow. The night that it rained. The reassuring voice that I had heard when I was standing in the fountain, the cool water washing over my feet, wanting the water to wash my soul away. I had resolved again, whatever it takes to survive this. Whatever it takes to live. The young man in San Diego who had brightened my Christmas by giving me a radio, allowing me to hear some Christmas music, even if only for a while. The people who volunteered to feed the homeless on a day when they wanted to be home with their families. All of the people who had searched for me. I was only beginning to understand everything that they had done. They had kept the search alive. They were the key to finding me. Were it not for them, no one would have recognized me once we had returned to Salt Lake City. Were it not for them, I'd be confined up on the mountain instead of lying in my bed. All of the people who had stopped to give us a ride or give us food or give us a little water as we hiked back from California. Yes, I had lived through many miracles. I had experienced tender mercies that literally kept me alive. I had been carried by the love of others, and in many ways, I had been blessed. Rolling over, I pulled a blanket around my chin and thanked God once again that I was home. Chapter 39, Trial. November 2010. It had been almost 8 years since I had seen Brian David Mitchell. During that time, I had finished high school, pursued a degree at BYU in music performance, had a few boyfriends, been to a lifetime of receptions, got a new dog, enjoyed many nights with my family, and made a lot of friends. I'd been skiing and camping and riding on my horse. I had enjoyed picnics and vacations and warm summer nights in my backyard. At the time of the trial, I was living in Paris, where I was serving an 18-month volunteer mission for my church. I had been able to come home and spend a few days with my family during the trial, but I looked forward to going back and finishing my service to the wonderful people I had come to love in France. During the same 8 years, Mitchell had been locked up in jail. He had told 1,000 lies and sung 1,000 songs. He had pretended that he was crazy and manipulated a few doctors into believing that his insanity was real. He had continued to insist that he was a holy prophet and that he spoke to God. He had pretended that he was sick, sometimes dropping into seizures upon the floor. He had been betrayed by his own wife and faced 12 different prison cellmates, none of whom appreciated what he had done. He had become a media sensation, his bearded face and narrow eyes making him one of the most recognized criminals in the world. Now it was time for him to face the law. The federal courthouse is a large, tan, neoclassical sandstone building in downtown Salt Lake City. It has a fenced parking lot in the back, but all of the entrances are visible to the public. A large crowd had gathered outside the courthouse, many of them photographers and television crews who were frantic to get any kind of picture that they could publish in the press. I could hear them shouting as my unmarked van pulled into the court parking lot, surrounded by my family and a few key supporters, including a young woman named Katie Lund, who had served with me in France and had become my closest friend. I was escorted into the courthouse through a back door, ducking out of sight. I tried to ignore the press. We were taken into a private room to avoid the boisterous crowd that had assembled in the courtroom. Finally, and at the very last moment before the judge was to get the trial started for the day, I was taken into the courtroom. It was everything that you'd expect. A raised box for the jury, high ceilings, a beautiful wood dais for the judge. The courtroom was absolutely packed. I was led to a seat behind the prosecuting attorneys and their staff. A few minutes later, a large door to the right of the witness stand was pulled open. Everyone waited, but no one appeared. Then I heard him singing. It was not a beautiful sound. It was sick and scratchy, and the song was nearly unrecognizable. It seemed to take a long time, but he finally walked into the room. And there he was in all his glory. Brian David Mitchell, Emmanuel David Isaiah, the holy prophet of his God. His eyes were almost closed and his head was tilted upward just a little bit. He was thin, his cheekbones sunken underneath his hollow eyes. He wore the same beard, but it was fuller now, and he had the same long hair. His hands were cuffed in front of him, and another chain ran around his back, holding his arms to his sides. The chains around his ankles made it difficult for him to walk, so he waddled into the courtroom, the sound of his chains clinking through the quiet room. He wore a simple pale shirt and loose-fitting pants. He was completely surrounded by security guards, but he seemed to ignore them. Walking into the courtroom, he kept on singing, an awkward and lonely sound. His guards escorted him to his seat at the table with his defense attorneys. The guards helped him to sit down, but with all of the chains around his hands and feet, he seemed to fall into his chair. And there he sat, his eyes closed, his head back, his voice filling the courtroom as he sang. I didn't take my eyes off of him. I wanted him to look at me, but he didn't. He kept on singing, his eyes closed, but I knew that he knew that I was there. I was anxious, mainly because I didn't know what to expect, not on any level. I was walking into the dark. What was he going to do? What was he going to say? How was he going to react when he finally looked at me? I thought he might stand up and shake his fist, telling me to repent. I thought he might scream out that I was an unfaithful wife who had betrayed the Lord's servant. I thought he might tell me that I had failed my earthly mission. I could imagine him doing any number of crazy things. But as I sat there, I realized I really didn't care. 9 years had passed since he snuck into my room to kidnap me. My life had gone on, and I had been able to do what my mother had told me. Don't you let him steal one more second of your life. Not one more second. You be happy. You move on. He was a nightmare, but it was over. I had woken up, and I was safe now. I had never let him hurt me or steal another moment of my life away. Soon the trial would be over, then I'd never have to see him or hear his voice or think about him again. This chapter in my life would be closed forever. I would go on with my life. Mitchell would go back to jail. I would be happy while he'd be... what? I didn't care. The trial was long. It seemed that some of the testimonies sounded more like personal resumes of lawyers trying to impress the audience than anything designed to prove guilt or innocence. Some of the testimonies made me mad. Some made me happy. Some of it bored me almost to tears. But there were parts of the trial that even now I can remember word for word. At one point, David Backman, one of the prosecuting attorneys, was questioning a defense witness, Dr. Stephen Golding, who was testifying that Brian David Mitchell was incapable of knowing right from wrong. Backman had a pen in his hand and he was walking toward the podium to write down some notes when he must have realized that he didn't need his notes to make his point. He threw the pen down and began. Dr. Golding, is Dr. Wellner a psychiatrist?
Yes, I think so.
Dr. Golding, is Dr. Gardner a psychiatrist?
Yes.
Dr. Golding, are you a psychiatrist?
No, I'm not.
No further questions, Your Honor. At that moment, I knew Mitchell wasn't going to get away with it. He wasn't going to be able to convince the jury or the world that he was crazy. He wasn't going to convince the jury or the world that he didn't know what he was doing. He wasn't a prophet. He hadn't received any visions. He hadn't talked to God. All he was a dirty pedophile who liked living on the streets. And though he never looked at me or spoke to me or acknowledged me in any way, there was one time when we did have a final communication between us. One morning, when things were not going very well for the defendant, Brian David Mitchell suddenly stopped singing, fell down, and started shaking on the floor. He was moaning and frothing and acting as if he were going to die. His attorneys fell beside him, cradling him in their arms. "Emmanuel! Emmanuel!" one of them cried. "Oh, come on," I thought. "This is ridiculous. All of us know this isn't real." The paramedics came running into the room and got him positioned on a gurney. It was then that Mitchell rolled his head to look at me. He stopped shaking. He stopped moaning. He looked me straight in the eyes. He seemed to smile an evil grin. It was almost as if I could hear him talking. The look on his face was so clear. "See? I have won, Sheer Jashub. I have won. Even now, when I am chained, I can do exactly what I want to do. If I want to finish this trial, I can make it end for the day. God has protected me. God will always protect me. I am his servant, and you are my wife." But even as horrible as he was to look at, nothing in that moment scared me or made me flash back. It didn't make me shrink away. It didn't make me cower. I wasn't afraid of the present. I wasn't afraid of what might come. I knew that I could stand on my own two feet. I knew that Mitchell would never hurt me again. So I returned his cold stare, never looking away. "No, Brian David Mitchell, I am stronger than you. I'm not afraid of my future, and I'm not afraid of you. Not another second will I give you. I will live, and I'll be happy. That is how this story ends." We seemed to stare at each other for a long moment, and then the paramedics wheeled the gurney away. Chapter 40, Gratitude and Faith. When I go around the country and talk to different groups, I always get asked the same questions. How did you survive? And how did you overcome what has happened to you? The answer to the first question is pretty simple. The main reason I was able to survive is because of my God, my family, and my community. The answer to the second question is a little harder to explain. I think a few people might look at me and almost not believe what I say. Some of them might think, given the fact that I haven't received any professional counseling, that something must still be wrong with me, that I'm hiding my wounds or putting on a happy face. Some might think that I'm carrying a bit of baggage, or that there are certain things that I'm not ready yet to face. But it's very important to stress that every survivor must create their own pathway to recovery. What works for one might not work for another. Therapy, medicine, and counseling might be the right path for some people, but not for others. The fact that I chose a pathway to recovery that worked for me is not to suggest that it's the best path or that it's the only path. The only thing it suggests is that I found the path that worked for me. My parents made it very clear that they would do whatever it took to help me. Every option was on the table. Counseling, therapy, doctors and medication, whatever it took to secure a happy future. But while we talked about the possibility of therapy or counseling, I never felt it was the right thing for me. So how was I able to get past all the horrible things that happened? First, I want to remind you of my mother. There are certain pains that only a mother can really feel, exquisite and intense, and my mother endured them all. She endured them day and night. She endured them for 9 months. She wondered if I was dead. It's one thing to lose your child, but it's something altogether different to have your child stolen out of her own bed. She endured months of bitter scrutiny, with some of the most horrible things being said about her family. In her darkest hours, she imagined all the suffering that I might be going through, and now she knows about it, the pain that I endured and the things that I was forced to do. But she didn't let any of these things stop her. She remains the strongest woman I have ever known. She is full of faith and hope and optimism. So, you see, I come from a very strong mother. In fact, I come from a long line of strong women. Maybe I inherited a little of their stock. And there is also significant historical precedent that indicates that what I've been able to do is not terribly unusual. The truth is, history is replete with stories of human suffering. The world has been full of brutality and abuse and suffering since the beginning of man. There are examples of those who suffered abuse as I did, maybe in different forms or from different sources, but I am not the first one to suffer at the hand of an evil man. And there were other kinds of challenges. Some of my own ancestors were early pioneers. They faced suffering and starvation, the loss of their children, the loss of other loved ones. They too endured the gamut of emotions, from utter devastation to life-saving miracles. But the human spirit is resilient. God made us so. He gave us the ability to forgive, to leave our past behind, to look forward instead of back. I'm not the first one who has ever done this. People have been doing it for generations. Since the beginning of time, men have found ways to heal. So what I did may not be so exceptional when you consider the entire scope of human experience. But there are some things that helped me. I have always loved horses and horseback riding. Even as a young child, I would much rather watch Black Beauty or Wild Hearts Can't Be Broken than anything else. For me, there's something very special about these wonderful animals. Their strength, their power, the way they learn to trust you, the way you can learn even as a child to control them, the way they learn to depend on you, to treat you as an equal, even though the fact is that in many ways, you're not. I loved riding before I was kidnapped, and I loved it even more once I got back. But horses aren't like cars. You don't just get on, throw the horse into gear, and go until you stop. Even a good horse might spook at a shadow, a tree, or a rock, even if they have walked on the same trail 100 times before. Maybe this time the sunlight hits an object a little differently, or maybe there's a different scent in the air, a different wind, or maybe you are sitting a little forward in the saddle. You always have to be on your toes with horses, never taking them for granted. And for me, there's just something therapeutic about being around them, riding them, feeding them, brushing them and currying their manes, going into nature and forgetting all the worries of this life. I also think that if you take care of your horses and are gentle with them and work with them through their moments of fright, Horses become a pretty accurate mirror of what kind of person you are. I have learned that a horse isn't going to treat you any different than you treat them. So I have always loved horses, but more than anything else, I loved riding with my Grandpa Smart. Grandpa Smart, despite being an oncologist, was a true cowboy. Not the city kind with smooth boots that had never stepped into a corral and buttoned down denim shirts. He was the real kind, the kind who grew up taking care of animals, who loved them and related to them. If some men are all hat and no horse, my grandpa was all horse and a well-worn hat. I loved riding with him, but it was always a challenge. He'd lead me bushwhacking through the forest, over the face of what felt like sheer cliffs, wading through ice-cold rivers. There was something simply wonderful about horseback riding with him, and we did a lot of it after I got back. Grandpa never pushed me or pried. He simply brought me along to enjoy the ride. He used to say that some people talk too much. Ride more, talk less. That was his approach to life. Going with him, you always knew you were in for an adventure, but at the same time, you knew you'd be left alone to your thoughts. From him, I developed a true appreciation for the beauties of nature, silence, and being able to step away from the immediate and look at the big picture. This helped me to make decisions and to see my life and to see my problems with a little more clarity. And again, I'm not alone. Horses and riding have been credited with helping many others through some of life's most difficult challenges, including some serious illness. Ann Romney said that horses gave her the energy and strength to get out of bed, helping her to deal with her multiple sclerosis. Other treatment programs have been designed around the care of other animals. I suppose that riding was my therapy, and it was very effective. My Grandpa Smart passed away in January of 2006. I miss him a lot, but the things that he taught me absolutely changed my life. I had another source of therapy that has helped me throughout my life. One December, when I was 5 years old, my mom took me Christmas shopping. While we were downtown, I saw a huge Christmas tree with an angel on top that was playing the harp. I remember looking up and thinking, I want to be put on the top of a Christmas tree. I guess the only way to do that is to play the harp. That was the beginning. I can't say that I was a perfect student who lived to practice, because I wasn't. There were plenty of times that my mom or dad had to physically come in and sit down with me for the duration of my practice session. But I got pretty good, and I developed a great love for playing music. When I came home, nothing could speak my feelings better than the harp. I know this sounds cliche, but I think that every musician feels the same way. Music is the unspoken language that can convey feelings more accurately than talking ever could. So playing the harp became extremely therapeutic for me. If I ever felt sad or angry or frustrated, I would sit down and start playing. Once I had submerged my heart into my music, my feelings evaporated, and I could go out and face the world again. Besides that, if you have ever heard the harp, then you understand that it is not possible to stay upset for long while playing such a beautiful instrument. Clearly, there is a reason that heavenly angels are depicted playing harps. All of these things have helped me, but ultimately, to get better, I simply made a choice. Life is a journey for us all. We all face trials. We all have ups and downs. All of us are human, but we are also the masters of our fate. We are the ones who decide how we are going to react to life. Yes, I could have decided to allow myself to be handicapped by what happened to me, but I decided very early that I only had one life and that I wasn't going to waste it. As of this writing, I am 25 years old. I have been alive for 307 months. 9 of those months were pretty terrible, but 298 of those months have been very good. I have been happy. I have been very blessed. Who knows how many more months I have to live, but even if I died tomorrow, 9 out of 307 seems like pretty good odds. Looking at it that way, I don't think I have much to complain about. People sometimes ask me if I'm happy. Have I truly been able to move on with my life? Have things turned out okay for me? I want you to know that they have. I am happy. I am fulfilled. I'm satisfied and at peace with myself and the life that I have built. I once heard an old saying, I never said it would be easy. I only said it would be worth it. I think that's about right. Like everyone, I have my challenges, but I have learned from them and they have helped to make me better. There is one other very important explanation for why I've been able to overcome what happened to me. I believe in gratitude. When I first got home from being kidnapped, I was so grateful to be back with my family. So grateful that they cared and had not given up on me. I was so grateful for a roof over my head, a bed to sleep in, and hot water to take a bath. I was so grateful for food to eat, for shoes that fit, for clean clothes. I was grateful for literally everything. Then, when my mom shared her advice with me, I made the firm resolution that I would always be grateful and never feel sorry for myself. I resolved that whenever I might have any doubts or moments of weakness, and I knew that they would come, I would tell myself, Elizabeth, you have everything back now, but you remember all those hard times, right? And because you remember all those hard times, you can remember the depth of your gratitude. And I have also learned that my challenges can help me reach out to others with more empathy and understanding than I could ever have had before. When we are faced with a challenge, it is very easy to be mad or upset. But when we have passed our great test, we are given opportunities to reach out to other people. We are able to affect change in a way that otherwise we wouldn't have been able to. Because of the things I have lived through, I can help other people now. I can reach out to other victims and help them to learn to be happy. Because I have actually lived through these experiences, I am able to be a voice for change. If I hadn't had this terrible experience, I'm not sure that I would have cared enough about these issues to become involved. And even if I did become involved, I wouldn't be able to do many of the things that I've been able to do. I'd just be another young girl who doesn't really know what she's talking about. I'm grateful for these opportunities that I've had to help other people. They have blessed my life. Gratitude has also helped me to keep a healthy perspective. One of my favorite movies is Ever After with Drew Barrymore. For those of you who have not seen it, it is another version of Cinderella. One of my favorite lines from the movie is when the evil stepmother tells Cinderella, "We mustn't ever feel sorry for ourselves. Because no matter how bad things are, they can always get worse." Now, I know that sounds kind of pessimistic, but when I was being held captive, every time I thought that things couldn't get any worse, somehow, they always did. So instead of looking at the evil stepmother's words as being cold-hearted and mean, I now translate them to say, we always have something to be grateful for because there will always be something that could make your situation worse. The first time Mitchell made me go naked and said we were playing Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden, I didn't think anything could be worse. Now I look back and I am grateful that I wasn't being filmed and then exploited and traded through the internet like so many other children have been. I'm so grateful that my captors were strangers and in no way connected with me. I don't have to go home every night and see them or see pictures of them hanging on the wall or know that even though my family is so upset with what they might have done to me, there is still a piece of their hearts that cares and loves the abusers because they are their children or parents or brothers and sisters. And there were other examples too. Just when I thought it couldn't get any worse, Mitchell would make me do something that made me sick. Just when I thought it couldn't get any worse, I went 7 days without anything to eat. Just when I thought it couldn't get any worse, Mitchell made me drink until I woke up in my own vomit. Knowing it can always get worse, I try to be grateful for whatever good I have. I always believe in faith. Faith in a loving and kind Heavenly Father who will always care about me. Faith that my worth will never be diminished. Faith that God knows how I feel and that I can depend on Him to help me through it all. I believe that God not only suffered for me, but that He will make everything up to me in His own time and his own way. That gives me the peace I need to feel like justice will win out in the end. That is why I could eventually forgive my captors. That is not to say that I want to ever see them again, or that I would ever invite them to Sunday dinner. Believe me, I don't. Every life that they have ever touched, they did their best to destroy. But that is not for me to judge. I don't have to spend even a second of my life worrying about what happens to Brian David Mitchell or Wanda Barzee. The morning after I was rescued, I was able to write a message to the world. I don't have it anymore, and I don't remember every word, but this is essentially what it said. I want to thank everyone for what they did for me. I consider myself the luckiest girl in the world. I am so grateful for everyone who prayed for me. I am so grateful for everyone who searched for me, or followed my story, or did everything they could to try to bring me home. Your efforts all made a difference, and I want to tell you all, thank you. Even now, after all these years, I still feel the same way. So I'll say it again. To all of you who helped me, or prayed for me, or tried to bring me home, thank you. I will always be grateful. I love you for what you've done.
Epilogue. Elizabeth Smart is now a nationally recognized advocate for children's rights. She is president of the Elizabeth Smart Foundation, which advocates for change related to child abduction and recovery programs and legislation. As well as being involved in the Elizabeth Smart Foundation, Elizabeth has helped promote the National Amber Alert, the Adam Walsh Child Protection and Safety Act, and other safety legislation to help prevent abductions. She also helped to develop a survivor's guide titled You're Not Alone, The Journey from Abduction to Empowerment, to encourage children who have gone through similar experiences to not give up and know that there is life after tragic events. Elizabeth met her future husband while serving her LDS mission in Paris, France. Elizabeth describes Matthew Gilmore, who is a fellow missionary from Scotland, as the nicest, most genuine, and most honest person that she has ever met. On February 18, 2012, they were married in the Hawaiian LDS temple, starting their very happy lives together. On May 21, 2010, Wanda Barzee was sentenced to 15 years in federal prison for her role in the kidnapping and sexual assault of Elizabeth Smart, as well as 1 to 15 years at the Utah State Prison for the attempted kidnapping of Smart's then 15-year-old cousin. The sentences are to run concurrently. On May 15, 2011, having been convicted of kidnapping Elizabeth Smart at knife point, holding her hostage for 9 months, and subjecting her to horrific abuse, Brian David Mitchell was sentenced to life in federal prison. Under the federal system, he has no chance of parole.
We hope you found this book interesting and enjoyable, and remember, sharing is caring.
Join the struggle to make information free for everyone.